Welcome to Alberta Conservation Association's Harvest Your Own podcast, the resource for everything hunting, navigating through the field, the butcher shop, and the kitchen. Life is all about great food. Let's get started.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Brad Fenson, an avid outdoor enthusiast who has worked as a freelance journalist, photographer, and public speaker for over three decades. I have hunted, fished, and foraged all my life and hope to share my passion for the outdoors. Along the way, I want to encourage everyone to harvest wild proteins and enjoy the satisfaction of providing the next meal for your family. Our goal is to educate, entertain, and inspire individuals to get outdoors and create a connection between food, health, and your future meals. Welcome to Harvest Your Own. Today we have a guest, a biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association, Doug Manzer, the Senior Scientist and Wildlife Program Manager. That's quite a title. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be here, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I figured you'd be the perfect person to chat with about Alberta's upland game birds. You've spent time getting your doctorate, correct? Studying some of our native grouse and still have active research going on and experimental farms and all kinds of things dealing with the birds. So you should be right up to date on all the information.
Well, I've certainly had a lifelong interest in game birds and grouse in particular, but you know, all the species that we are able to hunt here in Alberta, I really have an interest in them.
Right. And we're kind of spoiled because Alberta has a very diverse habitats, and that leads to diversity in terms of the game birds we have as well.
Certainly. Yeah. In fact, you know, compared to a lot of other jurisdictions, yeah, we're rich in our ability to hunt, you know, forest birds and those birds that are in the more open areas and prairie areas. And we have, you know, really a bird for almost any occasion when you think of it. And if you add waterfowl on top of that, you know, it's very rich for us.
Yes. And even when we head to the mountains, you know, the blue grouse and different species of ptarmigan and even some, do we call them subspecies, like a Franklin versus a spruce grouse?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's quite diverse. And, you know, I actually don't know if I've met anyone who's tried or has successfully harvested all of Alberta's for upland birds in one season, but you might be the guy. Have you ever done that, Pat?
No, I've certainly thought about it and been right down to trying to find some ptarmigan walking some of the basically late season sheep country.
Yeah. Oh boy, those late season ptarmigan, that's tough. That's hard handling.
It is, because they don't like getting up either, and they're easy to walk right past.
Yeah. Well, I feel that. I tried that a couple of years ago, and I was out there, I think, in November, and that was a bitterly cold pursuit, I'll tell you.
Yeah. We should perhaps start a passport to Alberta's upland game birds, and hunters can go out and get a stamp for every species and see how many people could actually get them all.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because you'd have to cover a lot of different terrain and, you know, and have a pretty good knowledge of how they sort of partition themselves out across the landscape and what particular species like and what others prefer instead.
Absolutely. It would be, like you said, it would be very tough to achieve in 1 year, but I think anyone that set goals could do it over a number of years for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And some of the ones, when I think of just obviously with our forest grouse, our primary species, rough grouse and spruce and blues are a little bit tougher, probably in far fewer areas in Alberta, but those three are probably commonly harvested. And then our prairie birds, you know, they're commonly harvested, but just having the time and the motivation to do all of them and then add in ptarmigan on top of that, that's where it gets challenging.
Yeah. It's as a sheep hunter, I've run across several places where there's actually good populations. So it narrows it down, but it's never easy to get to.
Yeah, and you're obviously not running around up there with a scatter gun, so that probably makes it a challenge.
Yeah, no, that's no more extra weight, no packing things that make loud noises, so it makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about native upland birds versus introduced or non-native.
Yeah. So we have, like in the province, we've got three non-native upland birds, and that's including wild turkeys. And then in addition to that, we have pheasants and gray partridge, which are commonly referred to as Hungarian partridge or hunts.
Right.
And it's for the most part, well, sharptails are really distributed across the province. And if I was just characterizing them, because they use so many types where they're distributed so broadly, all the way from Alaska really down to Oklahoma, that, you know, the common characteristic that you would associate with a sharp tail and all the subspecies of sharp tails is that they're an open area bird. So even in a forested landscape, if you have a really large burn that goes through and might clear out, you know, an area that might be 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers, you potentially could have an area like that that might be colonized over a period of time by sharp tails. And the same would hold true with some of the large open boggy areas in the north. As long as it's open and devoid of really tall trees or trees, really, you can have sharp tails that'll live in those systems. We more commonly think of them as being within Alberta, as being in the open areas of the parkland. So areas of parkland that have broad open spaces. And I would say that at a landscape level, that would be, you know, like three quarters or at least a section of land open in an area, and for, you know, mostly native grasses. And then throughout the prairies where they're more common, or often more common, and then it's basically grassland as opposed to cropland.
Right. They are an amazing bird. It's the only species I've seen while up in the Arctic on the Dempster Highway, like you said, in burns, the big Chisholm burn that went through south of Slave Lake many years ago holds an incredible amount of sharp tails, and they've certainly been able to find it and colonize it, or I guess they were always there, but the habitat conditions improved for them in the short term until the trees start growing back and their populations boom.
Yeah, you know, and I haven't hunted in that area. I was up at Dempster, as you know, already this past fall, and I didn't have a chance to see sharp tails, but there was a bridge closed, and we couldn't get quite far enough up the highway, I think, to where we would have had a better chance of seeing them. But it is amazing to me that they will colonize an area that, frankly, didn't have sharp tails historically, and yet it might be 100 kilometers away from where a known sharp tail lek might be, and where it would be suitable habitat. And sooner or later, well, not all the time, but they often are able to find those spots. And, you know, no one has really been able to explain that, because, I mean, I've certainly looked, but I've never seen migrating sharp tails flying in the air like ducks. So.
No, it is a strange phenomenon, though, like to have them move that far and not know if the habitat's there to support them is a risky move, no matter what part of the population is doing it.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. It's a curious feature. Curious thing.
Yeah, makes it interesting. And then I guess the easiest way to tell the native birds from non-native is just to look at their feet.
Sure. Yeah. So our native birds are going to have feathers all the way down covering their toes. And our non-native birds, so they're Hungarians and pheasants and turkeys, they're basically bare on their feet. And so I guess in general, our native species are probably better conditioned to handle our more harsh winters that we have in Canada. But these other species seem to be adapting reasonably well. There is a cutoff point where, and there are sort of adaptations that the different species have taken on. I know, like, even though Hungarian partridge or gray partridge aren't thought of as being snow roosters, you know, I've recently been sent some pictures by some keen enthusiasts where, you know, Hungarians do actually, they'll hole up next to a bale or something, and they actually can have even snow tunnels underneath the snow where when you get blowing snow occurring over winter. Although pheasants often can get caught in a snowstorm, and you can find them like places where they would have been maybe in some thick shrubs or in the cattails, and then they're sort of underneath the snow line during cold snaps and blowing snow. Although in general, they're not, those species aren't considered to be snow roosters, as would be, say, a ruffed grouse. When we get a period of time of, say, 20 below, 30 below, and the snow has not been crusted over, so it's fairly, needs to be fairly deep, like probably at least 30 centimeters deep, and it's still fluffy, they'll burrow underneath the snow and spend the night, and sometimes up to 23 even, of, you know, most of the hours in a day in a snow roost just to get out of the cold.
Very interesting. I did not know about them, but they are survivors. You know, there's always a way to beat Mother Nature and live where you're going to live, whether you're people or a rough grouse.
Yeah, it's cool because, you know, when you think about even the use of have shelters that humans have adapted to, and certainly say snow shelters where we sort of dig into it, either dig an igloo or make an igloo or dig into a snow cave. You know, it's the same principle. You can really utilize your body temperature much more effectively when you're insulated from the cold above.
Right. And, you know, our, those upland birds don't have the down that a waterfowl species would have. So I would think their blood flows better, or there has to be some explanation as to why our upland birds have less insulation but can survive the winter quite well.
Yeah, they really are amazing, you know, the way they're able to achieve that. And you know, our non-native species, like, they're trying to adapt. And, you know, wild turkeys are, you know, right, almost right across Canada in 6 of the 10 Canadian provinces. And they seem to be adapting quite readily to our more harsh Canadian winters than further than below the line. And, you know, is that evolving over time? It certainly seems to be adaptations that are occurring. Although in Alberta, here with our wild turkey population, they're quite reliant on cattle operations in winter so that they can access enough food to keep warm over winter. And then they roost in trees. And so that roosting in trees of all the species I mentioned, like, well, some of them do roost in trees, but turkeys, you know, pheasants and Hungarians don't generally roost in trees in Alberta. Although, you know, if you were in a different country, say in Europe, pheasants over there would roost in trees at night. So it's funny how these species, like, even when you bring them into North America, they just don't seem to, they haven't really taken to a tree, you know, doing that very, very often. Whereas in Europe, it's very common to see a pheasant in a tree.
Very interesting.
Yeah, interesting, yep. Adaptations.
Adapting to the predators that are there, perhaps the, you know, foxes on the ground versus, it's not much better here.
So their density of certainly with the foxes in particular, but also some of their other predators, I think is quite a bit greater than in many cases for us. And for places over there that are raising birds or raising, say, pheasants for hunting, then they would even encourage their pheasants to spend time in trees.
Right.
And then, you know, historically in Alberta, where we have pheasants that have occurred since 1908, that's when the pheasants were successfully introduced into Alberta. Most of those areas don't have, you know, a lot of trees around, and that wasn't really part of the system. And the southern part of Alberta where the pheasants are able to exist, you know, is generally a non-treed environment, although you do get trees around homesteads and in some of the river bottoms. But still, I have yet to hear someone that says our pheasants regularly roost in trees at night, whereas that would be common,
right,
you know, across the pond.
You know, it's all good information, because people that are starting out grouse hunting probably don't know where to look. And we talk about rough grouse making snow caves and staying in there for 23 hours. That makes them very challenging to hunt. But a lot of them do get up in the trees. You know, a real good frosty morning is one of my favorite times to actually spot and photograph or even hunt sharptails, because they're often, a whole flock will be sitting in the top of a tree. I don't know if they're just trying to soak up some of the sun that's coming to burn off the frost, or if they just like to have an alert view of their surroundings when it's available.
You know, I think it is a couple of things there. I think they do like to be in the sun, but they'll sometimes be, say, in a type of deciduous tree and eating the buds. So that would be common.
Yes.
But oftentimes, so they're a lekking species, and so the males aggregate at a lek and they dance. And that, of course, would occur in spring. But in fall, sort of during the same photo period, so the middle of October, there'll often be these congregations of males on leks, and they'll dance a bit. And I think that sometimes those females, they'll get up into trees and they'll maybe be listening, you know, for dancing in the distance. Or it could also be some of those immature males that aren't part of the male group yet that are maybe trying to figure out what to do and where to go. So I sort of associate it with that photo period that's similar to that dancing period that happens in April as well.
This podcast is produced for Harvest Your Own, a program dedicated to those who want to reconnect with food and health through their experiences outdoors. HarvestYourOwn.ca is a resource for individuals to learn more about hunting and the outdoors. There's information to get you started and ensure that your compass stays pointed in the right direction to be successful. Where's your next meal coming from?
You know, again, for hunters starting out trying to figure out more about these species, this is a good talk because you can also catch rough grouse up in the trees, as you mentioned. They eat buds, and the late season, if they're not in a snow roost somewhere, they're often up in the alders or even the willows eating the buds, and it's you got to readapt your eye in terms of what you're looking for when you're out hunting. But once you key into them in the prime times, like the first hour of the day and especially the last hour, you learn to spot them up off the ground.
Yeah, you know, it's a good point. And you just track. Like when I'm out hunting and there's snow on the ground, you know, just paying attention to tracks with grouse. And it's fairly easy to tell which ones are made, you know, today versus yesterday or in the past. And that's a great indicator. And you know, the snow roosting thing, I don't think as hunters we need to worry about it. Oh, they're all going to be subsurface when we're out today. Because for the most part, when they're going to be snow roosting, I doubt very much that we're likely going to be hunting them for the most part. So you know, that's probably not a very nice day to be out. But I love to go out after a snowfall and you've got a, like there's sun out today and it was really overcast and it was snowing yesterday a bit at our place. And I know if I was to go out in the forest behind the house now and take the dogs for a walk, I'll see fresh grouse tracks. And it's just a great, you know, a great time to be out and when you can see them after a fresh snowfall and on a sunny day. And there's something about that sun. I think everything just likes to get out and move around a little bit.
I have to agree that I think the sunny days are always the best for grouse, and they seem to be a little bit more active and they're easier to flush and other things like that. So it weather can certainly play a big role in their movement and how tight they hold to the ground for some of them.
Yeah, no, I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
They're just like a cat. They like to be in the sun sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. So we do have very liberal seasons in Alberta. Like we talked about the diversity. There's an incredible diversity and long seasons. Many of them open September 1st and run right through to January 15th. And that late season is more of a new concept in Alberta, giving hunters more of an opportunity to get out. Let's talk about hunting and harvest of birds and the law of diminishing returns. You know, I had a biologist years ago tell me that you can't really herd an upland population because somewhere between 0.7 and 0.9 of them survive one whole year. So they have a very high mortality rate.
Yeah. So I don't really agree with that. So, I mean, I've looked at this for a long time. And I think that is very dependent, like their survivorship is very dependent on the system they're in and even the year that occurs. But for the most part, even though these birds, and in general, all these types of birds can have fairly large clutch sizes, but they're still just trying to put on the ground or say, they're still trying to take into fall basically enough chicks that you'll have at least one extra female survive to breed that following spring. And so, you know, a general rule of thumb is somewhere between 2.5 to 3.5 or 4 chicks would be, you know, what you sort of need because you're going to assume to have a close to a 50-50 male versus female relationship. And the survivorship of all these species varies quite a bit depending on the system they're in. So as an example, so our non-native species would have higher winter mortality in general than our native species. And even though, say, a great partridge could have many chicks that can have, you know, 14 or 15, even 16 eggs in a clutch, and most of the time, all of those eggs are fertilized and they usually all hatch out. But the survivorship of those, just to get them to 30 days, is often tricky. For them, and you have most of your mortality that happens in that first 2 weeks before those chicks are able to fly and before they have enough feathers that have grown so that they can thermoregulate their own body heat. But those gray partridge chicks are actually more vulnerable in wintertime as well because they can't do the things that we already talked about quite as effectively as our native birds. So they'll have a little higher mortality rate through winter And it's often associated or correlated with the number of weeks of snowpack on the ground. So a winter like this, where we haven't really had much snowpack in many areas where there is gray partridge that occur, especially in southern Alberta, where you can have a snowfall and it will burn off in a week or two, that's a great winter for those birds. So I would anticipate that they would have higher winter survivorship this year. But that's, they would still likely lose, you know, they can have a loss of 5% of the of that population each month, even through winter, or even a little bit more than that, over a winter period. So you just have to stack that on top of the fact that you're lucky to have, you know, a four chicks that survive with the adults into fall, and then trying to get them to survive into next spring and become a breeding age female is hard to do. And I think what often, see with gray partridge, because they're usually found in such large groups when you're hunting, I think what may be confusing for some people, they might assume that when they flush a covey of partridge in October, that that's a family group. And yes, it probably is. It probably includes a family group, but gray partridge are very gregarious and they'll often have, say, other family groups that'll join into a primary one. Or if you have a male or a female or another pair that has lost the clutch, those adults will often join those groups in fall.
Interesting.
So a group of eight, could easily be a male and a female of a primary clutch with, say, three chicks of their own. And they could have, say, two males that have lost their mates through the breeding season, and then maybe another female which lost her mate, and those three all being adult birds. That that often happens. And these larger coveys that you'll find right now, where the you often find them in groups of 15 to up to 30, those are certainly groups of many different breeding pairs and coveys and adults that lost clutches through the season. So,
yeah, that's very interesting.
And that would, there's a different story to tell for each one of the species that we have, because they all have different strategies or slightly different strategies. But I would tend to say that, for the most part, in a population where they're having strong breeding success, we're far better. So that means that we've had really good clutch sizes that year, which, you know, doesn't occur every year. I often think of the magic number is closer to 30%. So if you have, you know, a good clutch size and we're harvesting those birds in September, October, November, that, you know, taking 30% of your population is in a very strong year is sort of a top limit. And then in years when it's not doing so well and, you know, you come across, you know, a group and you only have four or five in it, then, you know, I would use a lower proportion if I was going to take one, maybe, as opposed to, you know, two or three. And you can often tell that if you're harvesting birds, you know, in a season and you're harvesting a large portion of young of the year compared to adults, that's a good indicator that that population maybe is doing a little bit better. But if you're starting to harvest and you're getting 50-50 adults versus young of the year, then, you know, that population probably didn't do that well that year.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it's easy to age them. People that are listening might want to know, juvenile bird, his feathers are going to look fairly worn out and tattery on the ends, especially his tail feathers, whether it's a sharp tail or a ruffy. And adults have nice, yeah, uniform new feathers that they grew in during the summer, and they just don't look as ratty on the end. So that's probably the easiest way to tell a juvenile from an adult.
Yeah, I think so, across the board. Most of the time, if we're hunting in September and October, if you had an adult and a juvenile in, you know, one in each hand, you'll be able to tell just because of the size that the juvenile is going to be, you know, probably 2/3 the size of the adult, just in weight and size. And that would sort of span, I think, across, you know, among all those species, that would be a pretty typical trait.
Right.
And then some of them have, you know, real specific things that allow you to be able to tell as well. Like, so getting back to the gray partridge again, one of the reasons they're called gray partridge is because they have gray legs. And in some places they're called gray legs, not just as sort of a colloquial term, but an adult partridge, gray partridge, has gray legs, whereas a juvenile gray partridge has yellow legs. And they don't actually gray up until the winter of that first year. So if you harvest a young of the year partridge in October, the legs will look quite yellow as opposed to gray.
That's another interesting fun fact about our upland game birds.
There you go. Yeah.
We can't do the same with ruffies. You know, there's gray fays and red fays, and some of them are mixed up. But, I think there was some research going on to find out if there was a correlation of different colors to forest birds versus transition birds to farmland. I don't think there's been a set definition of why things are the color phase they are.
So there was a genetic study that was done a few years ago from a master's student out of Lethbridge, University of Lethbridge, and she looked at these different color phases across the province. And there were definitely areas where it was sort of like, subpopulations of birds that were gray versus red, I believe. But I don't remember the information accurately enough to really go into any detail on it.
It's funny because when I read about that study, I started to pay more attention. You know, are there more gray birds in the forest, and the ones we have in the parkland, are they tend to be red phase? And I found that there was a lot that had both colorations in them. It was quite interesting to pay attention to it.
Yeah, like when you hunt in your area, I know when I hunt in my area, like I can get both.
Right.
For rough grouse. So that would be the same for you in the parkland?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We see both color phases, and then lots of times it'll be a gray body with a red tail, which is interesting.
Just the very simplest things of being able to age grouse, but then also being able to differentiate, male from female is a handy thing for a grouse hunter to be able to do, or anyone for that matter. It's often hard to do it with most of our species unless you have them in hand. And even then, it can be a little bit tricky unless you know what you're looking for exactly. But I think it is a good thing for an upland hunter to be able to do. So they sort of understand, getting back to, what's my influence on population, and am I harvesting a lot of adult females? Well, which would be an example of a case where you might stop to think, I wonder if this is a good idea or not. But, with rough grouse, so I think that's an important part probably for people to think about a little bit, because, there is an influence. When we harvest adult females of any of these species, you are really affecting the motor of the population that's going to create the next generation. So it's ideal if we're just a little bit careful about that.
This podcast was made possible by Alberta Conservation Association and the Harvest Your Own community. If you're interested in harvesting your own food, there's a comprehensive collection of information. To gain insight and knowledge, head to the field, harvest your own protein, prepare it, and taste the results. HarvestYourOwn.ca is a library of information, from getting started and geared up to processing, butchering, and cooking wild game, to make the connection between health and food.
Yeah, I think you talk about being aware of some of these flocks having multiple adult birds, and especially the adult females. Hunting strategies can be important too. Anybody that's read Robert Ruark, The Old Man and the Boy, probably read the portions in there about how he always made them leave 50% of the quail in their area, because that was next year's stock. And if you tended to over-harvest, there would be no birds the following year.
Yeah, I remember reading that when I was a kid, and that certainly had an influence on me. And I would suggest that, so one of the things with Bob White is, depending on the area that you're in, sometimes they'll have more than one clutch in a year. And that doesn't occur with any of our birds. And so if that happens, Bob White can be, one pair could actually have two, or even, I think in some cases, even up to three clutches in a year. We don't have any of our upland birds that do that. And so that's why I get back to the 30%, and that's only in a good year. And understanding what a good grouse population is, or what a good Hungarian population is relative to the space that you're in, It takes a little bit of time for 100 to figure out. But I always think of it in terms of the number of movements per hour, or movements even per kilometer that I walk. And, you know, in a good year, say with Hungarian partridge, again, because Hungarians are actually spread out over a lot of the parkland and prairie area of Alberta. So lots of people are familiar with them. If I can move, you know, 4 or 5 coveys in an hour with my dog walking, that's a really good year. That would be contacts with 4 or 5 fresh coveys, let's say, not moving the same covey 4 or 5 times. That's a really good year, and it's not that common.
Right.
And I would say out of the last 10 years, we've had 2 of those years when it's been about like that. But in a bad year, or in a year when it's really low, you might be lucky to scare up a covey of maybe 8 or 10 birds, you know, maybe over an hour and a half or even 2 hours. And so that would be, you know, a poor year. And for every one of these species, and rough grouse, I would say, like, rough grouse, like, Alberta has had and documented information that suggests that we've had some extremely good years when you might be able to move, or you would have a density of, well, a few dozen rough grouse that would be in a quarter section. And you could have a fall density that would be several times greater than that. And so you might be able to move, you know, 10 birds in an hour, you know, in a really, really high year. But that doesn't occur very much in Alberta anymore. And I often find that you're lucky to be able to move, you know, a couple of rough grouse in an hour in an area that where the population is relatively low, where you might only have, you know, maybe 2 drumming males per quarter or per kilometer squared. And that's a relatively low grouse density. So getting back to the harvest side of that, that would suggest that if I only am moving, you know, a couple of grouse per hour for rough grouse, that I've got a relatively low population in there. And I would lean on the more cautious side of harvesting birds. And if I was in an area where I was, for whatever reason, you know, moving, you know, 10 or more birds in an hour, then I'd be, you know, feeling like I could go up to 30% in there.
Right. And it's a limiting factor on its own. Hunters that struggle to find birds have a shorter attention span, I believe. And on the tough years, I don't think the same effort goes in as when the birds are plentiful and, you know, hunter success rates high.
Yeah. And I think it's really spotty too. Like you can be in one area of Alberta, you know, I mean, it could just be 50 kilometers away, and you might have had some weather conditions, perhaps in June, which might have affected the hatch success in that given year. And then you can be 100 kilometers away, and either the habitat conditions or the those environmental or climatic conditions may be quite different, and you can have much greater densities. So, you know, that sort of brings us to, like, the rough grouse, because they're so widely distributed across Alberta. And then they've changed. I think their cyclicity has changed over the last 50 years so much, where they really don't cycle very much in Alberta anymore. We don't get the huge pulses where the densities are 10 times greater in a good year than they are in a bad year. That's kind of dampened out. And a lot of that has to do with the habitat quality that has been really eroded over that period of time. And to me, Brad, like, that often comes down to the fact that we have very effective fire suppression in Alberta. And I always associate, or generally associate, mature aspen as being, to some extent, if your aspen age across your area that you're trying to hunt in is all 40 years and above, you're not going to have good grouse densities in there. Rough grouse really want to have a mix of age classes of the forest that they're in. And that does include early successional habitat. So that would be that those age spans that are, say, anywhere from 1 to 10 years old. And they really like that higher stem density. It's part of the way their strategy for avoiding predators in the spring when they're breeding. So they're going to seek that out. And if they have a really good mix of early succession habitat, and that could be right next to mature habitat, so age stands that are 30 years and older, then that can be really good grouse habitat. But if it's just old age stands, and that's what we commonly see in the parkland now, are 40, 50, and 60-year-old aspen stands, the grouse, it just doesn't support high grouse density like it would if it was more mixed.
Right. I agree with that. It's interesting. And I'm always paying attention to those habitat details when I'm hunting the birds. And, you know, often where you find success, you can repeat it by finding similar habitats where the birds actually were spending time at that portion of the year.
Yeah. And so, you know, for the hunters out there that are keen to figure this out, that's why that, you know, the edge habitats are often really, really, you know, where to focus. Because on those edge areas, you can often have higher stem densities.
Yeah, all the little details that you pay attention to be successful in the end. Yes, yeah, paying attention to the habitat definitely makes a difference, no matter what species we're hunting. And you and I are kind of upland bird enthusiasts that would chase them in every corner of our province.
Yeah, for sure. And they all have these sort of niche areas where, like, sharptails like something a little different from partridge, and partridge and sharptails a little different from pheasants. And yet you can find them all overlapping in one area, but there'll be reasons why they're there and in some and other areas where they won't, all three species won't be there. And it just takes a little bit of time to figure that out as a hunter. But once you do, you know, it really starts to make sense over time. And they all sort of have things that they desire more maybe than their, than the other species.
Right.
And I generally, like, sometimes when people ask me about, say, pheasants versus sharptails or partridge, I sort of think about a pheasant a little bit more like a big whitetail or a white-tailed deer that really is more comfortable living in areas that have quite dense habitat to hide in. And a pheasant likes, you know, some areas that are dense to hide in. They nest in a little denser habitat than would a partridge or a sharptail. And the partridge and sharptails each use their vision, I think, more than a pheasant. They want to be able to see their predators coming from a long distance off, whereas a pheasant is more comfortable hiding and being in more dense habitat and hiding from them. So I would put a sharptail or a partridge might be more akin to a mule deer that, you know, likes to see something coming from several hundred yards off, whereas a pheasant might just hide there and let you walk right by.
Adaptations for survival.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I'd be remiss on the Harvest Your Own podcast if I didn't ask you, what is your favorite upland game bird recipe?
That's a good one. You know, I think the one that I go to more often than anything else, so if that might make it my favorite, is really simple. So if I'm out hunting for a few days, what I'll do is I'll take a little container and I'll just mix olive oil and balsamic vinegar in there, and I might even throw a few cloves of garlic. And I usually just carry that in a, you know, a container, like a half liter container or something. And if I'm harvesting, whether it's partridge or pheasants, or even sharptails on a trip like that, but usually say partridge or pheasants, I will just marinate those birds. Say if I harvest them today, I'll probably prepare them that night. I'll put them in a marinated bag overnight for eating the next day, and then the next evening I'll just grill them up for dinner.
Nice.
And it's a real quick and easy way to do it, but I love the sugar that you get out of that balsamic vinegar. It sort of it coats a little bit, and it just really sweetens up the meat.
The char on there is what makes it so wonderful.
It's just a wonderful way to go, especially if you're hunting several days on the trot. It's very, very simple to do as well. So that's probably my go-to recipe for, you know, in general for those types of birds.
Yes, and the other nice part about it is you can taste the bird. You know, you're not overpowering it or trying to disguise it. And our upland game birds are wonderful table fare. They all have a little bit different flavors, but they're very nice to the palate.
Yeah. If I get an older bird, one recipe that I've adopted from Hank Shaw is one that I would use sometimes for maybe older birds, older pheasants, but older sharptails as well. Is all just use sort of a deep fry approach with some flour and And then I'll make a sort of a sauce out of it after I deep fried it with sort of Franks and honey and garlic. And it's definitely, you can, you know, anyone who eats that, they may have a hard time identifying that it's a sharp tail in there. But I find it to be, and then you just strip the birds and make them into almost like finger strips. And that's sort of a, that's sort of an approach to maybe an older bird that's a little bit tougher or a little bit stronger. Certainly works well, and people generally love that as long as they like the sweet heat.
That always goes well with any of the upland game birds, and I've had some of the Hank Shaw's recipes as well, and Scott Laceth in the south. I've been down hunting birds with them, and it's always a treat to get to try them.
I think that's a snipe recipe that I just described, the one that he used on snipe. But I've tried that on snipe too, and just doing the whole bird, well, just having the bird on snipe and then deep frying it, bones and all, and with sort of the flour coating on the outside, and that's fantastic. I love that.
It sounds good. Yeah. Yes. Any other advice or wisdom for upland game bird hunters in the province?
Well, you know, I guess I would just encourage people to try the various species that we have and maybe try maybe something they're not particularly familiar with. And I would, you know, try not to get discouraged if you don't, you know, move a bird in the first 10 minutes. But I often think that, you know, people need to think about what the birds are using in an area to try and make themselves more successful. So that would be quite different depending on, you know, the species that you might be utilizing. And, you know, again, we could go through each sort of species and sort of tease that apart. But that'll probably take a little bit of investigation in order to be successful in the area that you want to go and hunt. And then a lot of it comes down to ideally having a dog. Like, a dog really makes your upland experience, I think, more rich, but also probably more successful, especially when you're looking for those more cryptic species like a pheasant, where they would very likely hide when you walk by them. And if you don't have a dog, you're likely walking by a lot of birds.
So yes,
there's that side of it.
More than you'd ever realize you walk past.
Yeah, for sure. And the other side of it, I would also suggest that, like upland hunting, there's a skill that comes with the use of a shotgun that, you know, you just can't anticipate that you were born with. That just doesn't happen. So getting out there and practicing with a shotgun and learning how to take birds on the wing is a discipline and an enjoyable one in and of itself that, you know, is something that really should be cultivated in order to get the most from your upland hunting experience. That way, when you're out there, you're able to capitalize on opportunities that present themselves, but also not to beat yourself up, because you'll know the difference between a good opportunity and maybe a poor one, because you've been shooting enough that you've kind of got that figured out a little bit. So I would encourage anyone who's going to go, you know, carry a shotgun into the, you know, after upland birds this next year, to spend, you know, to get out on the clay field and, you know, spend some time out there busting some clays ahead of time. And that'll be fun in and of itself, but also make your upland hunt much more enjoyable.
Absolutely. And it will improve your waterfowl success as well. Any type of wing shooting, the more practice you do, the better off you're going to be in the future.
Yeah, most certainly. Yeah. And, you know, I really enjoy that part of it as well. The beauty of shooting a shotgun and trying to do that well, and the experience of trying to, you know, really be in time with the bird. Like there's an elegance to that, which, you know, when it translates to being out there hunting for birds, makes the whole experience that much more rich.
Right.
And I think that's probably common among the upland hunters.
Yeah. It might be common, but maybe overlooked as something that's a real benefit from the hunt that we haven't stopped to think about. But yes, when things come together and it all works out, it's pretty rewarding.
Yeah. And, you know, the old adage about you get out of it what you put into it, there's nothing more true than upland shooting. It takes work to be a good upland wing shot. And it's one of those, unfortunately, the work is pleasurable, but I think, it's a discipline that needs to be cultivated over time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your words of advice today. Really appreciate the insight into different species and learning how to age birds and tell males from females and different habitat preferences. I think it's all very useful information for people that have been hunting grouse or are aspiring to start. So thanks for your information and input and your enthusiasm.
Oh, my pleasure, and thanks very much for the opportunity. Nice to chat, Bob.
We hope to inspire people to reconnect with nature and appreciate where your food comes from by harvesting your own. For more information on getting started or to learn specifics about the Field to Fork experience, visit harvestyourown.ca and follow on Facebook and Instagram. Check back often for new material, recipes, and videos that are posted regularly. Please subscribe to Harvest Your Own podcast and take the time to rate and review the show to help us build a dedicated core of passionate hunters as our regular audience. Until next time, embrace the outdoors and all it has to offer. Thanks for joining us.